60.
Major funding for the connection is provided by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com.
I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. The typical Horatio Alger story starts like this. One evening in October 1850, Thomas Mordaunt, a Boston merchant, was crossing over Cambridge Bridge when his attention was drawn to a young man walking some rods in advance of him. The night was dark, and it was with some difficulty that he could discern the figure or his movements. An impulse seized him to hasten his steps. It was fortunate that he did so, for the young man stopped and suddenly climbed the railing of the bridge. He would have flung himself into the river had not Mr. Mordaunt hastily seized his arm. And if you know Horatio Alger, you already know that the young man was distraught over his gambling habit, but Mr. Mordaunt saved him, staked him to a new life, and at the very end of the story, some years later, when Mr. Mordaunt himself is in business difficulty, he is rescued by his young protege. Hard work, thrift, and good character, the secrets to success. But America's enduring belief in a classless society is getting a careful second look these days. For though the gap between the wealthy and the poor is greater than at any time in this country's history, the idea that opportunity is a national and individual birthright lives on. Connection listeners, why does the belief in rags to riches endure? Where do you see this peculiarly American notion of a classless society reflected? Does it shape popular culture and politics, or is it shaped by popular culture and politics? Our number's 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining us today, Neil Gabler. Neil is a cultural historian and film scholar. He is also the author most recently of Life the Movie, How Entertainment Conquered Reality. Welcome to The Connection, Neil.
Thank you very much, Dick.
How far do you look back for this link between the classless society and culture? Do we look at Horatio Alger, but even before that, perhaps?
Oh, I think before Horatio Alger. I mean, this is a deep-seated idea in American culture. Not that we're a classless society. I mean, that is not, I really think, the issue. The issue is whether we have enough mobility in the society that one can move from one class to another. I mean, it was always assumed that there were classes, and indeed there was quite a bit of class tension in this country, particularly, you know, through the 19th century and even into the 20th. But the assumption was always that class was a personal choice. It was a function of personal responsibility. That, as Horatio Alger said, if you had the right character, if you had the right work habits, if you had the right diligence, that you could move from the lower classes to the upper classes.
And is he right?
And so that's a pretty stubborn idea. Is he right? Well, statistics would say no. Now, there's an interesting thing here, because all of us live in two worlds. We live in a macro world and we live in a micro world. We live in the world of a large economic system, and we live in an antidote. Now, in the world of the larger economic system, you know, he's wrong. I mean, class mobility, social mobility, is limited today. And the chances that you're going to rise, any single individual is going to rise from one class to another, are increasingly slim. It's just not likely to happen. Chances are that whatever class you're born into, whether you're rich, middle class, or poor, is the class you're going to die in. Now, anecdotally speaking, one can give thousands, if not millions, of examples of individuals who have risen from one class to another. And again, you know, we live in anecdote. We don't live in a macro world. We do, of course, but we don't see the macro world. All we see is the anecdote. All we see is what's right in front of us. And so when we hear the story about an individual who has moved from one class to another, we say, of course, that's the American way. That's the way it can happen. That could be me.
But the idea that we live in some kind of imaginary world, do we really make decisions about what we're going to do and how we're going to raise our children and how we will spend the money that we have based on that rather than the reality?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, the argument I make in Life the Movie was that we may be the first generation to have the opportunity to write our own scripts. Now, that doesn't mean that we can fulfill our own scripts, because, as in the movies, there are all sorts of impediments, financial resources, cooperation of other people, illness. I mean, there are many, many things that can prevent us from fulfilling our script. But at least we can begin to think in terms of writing a script of our own expectations and being able to realize the movie of our lives, whether it's in the things we buy, the place we live, the clothes we wear, the car we drive, the place that we send our children to, the people we associate with, all of these things one might consider as being, you know, props or parts of this life movie that we create for ourselves. And we have come to believe, and of course we've been encouraged to believe, that we can realize this movie, and to a certain extent, again, there are many, many impediments, to a certain extent we can, so long as we dream within the right parameters.
Now, are you telling me that I imagine myself in the place of a Tom Hanks or a Brad Pitt, and sort of project myself into the fictional lives that I see on the screen, or that because we are so caught up in this life of narratives that are fictional, the movie narratives, that we actually construct our own lives that way?
It's the latter rather than the former. I don't think that any of us really believe watching the screen that we're going to become Tom Cruise or Brad Pitt. But I think we take the template of the movies and incorporate that into our own lives. And we're encouraged to do this. I mean, there's a whole industry that encourages us to do this. I mean, what is Ralph Lauren if not the clothier, the costumer for our life movie? I mean, what he tells us is that if you dress like an Englishman, you can kind of become an upper-class Englishman. Or if you dress in a safari outfit, you can imagine yourself as being, you know, in darkest Africa. Or if you dress in his Western outfit, you can kind of imagine yourself as a rugged Western individualist. Now, that's just one example. But the point is that we conceptualize our lives increasingly, I believe, in these narrative terms.
But if we talk about those trappings of class that we saw when we were much younger, or that our parents used to measure themselves, it would seem to me, Neil, to be easier today to play golf or play tennis or get on an aircraft and go to a hot country and have a vacation, that these things which were those features that defined class for our parents don't actually stand as divisions anymore. So maybe there's some truth to this.
Well, what you're saying is not necessarily true. Let me just cite a few statistics. Here are some statistics from the Congressional Budget Office, that income for middle-class families adjusted for inflation rose from $41,400 in 1979 to $45,100 in 1997, or 9%. In other words, the average American is only slightly better off now than he was then in 1979. Now, this idea that essentially income has been stagnant in this country, and it has been largely stagnant, it's only increased by roughly 10%, is obscured by a whole number of factors, one of the most important of which is that many, many, many families, if not most families now, have two incomes. When I was growing up, my mother didn't work. Mm-hmm. My mother didn't think of working. My father brought home the bacon. Today, in my family and in many, many others, I mean, both parents work. And we don't think anything of it. It's not even, you know, registers on our consciousness anymore. It's just the way that business is done in this country. But there are a number of other factors as well, I think, that obscure the fact that, you know, in real terms, the middle class has not been advancing anywhere near the rate of the upper classes in this country. Now, has life improved? Yes, it has improved. I mean, the standard of living has improved. I don't think there's any question about that. But when you think about the rate of improvement, given how vast the wealth of this country is, it's an amazement, it's an astonishment that the middle class, and the poor especially, aren't in some kind of you know, revolution against the distribution of wealth, the gains that that this country has undergone,
or the tax
in terms
cuts
of its wealth. Well, the tax cuts, of course, you know, are one of the major forces that essentially redistribute wealth in this country from the middle class and the poor to the upper class.
So what's your explanation, Neil? Are we delusional?
Oh, we are delusional. We're willfully delusional. And why shouldn't we be? I mean, one could say, psychologically speaking, that, you know, not to be delusional is really kind of idiotic. I mean, everyone wants to believe in his or her own personal responsibility. Everyone wants to believe that he or she is the one who will determine how successful he or she will be. I mean, who doesn't want to think of that? And again, you know, I used this word earlier, encourage. That idea is encouraged by a whole host of forces, not the least of which is American popular culture. I mean, when you go to the movies, you don't see systems squashing people. You don't see, you know, a plutocracy on screen preventing ordinary middle-class people from realizing their dreams. That's not the typical American narrative. In fact, the typical American narrative is that Horatio Alger narrative. What you see is, to take one recent example, Made in Manhattan. The hardworking, single Latino mother who's a maid at a posh New York hotel is going to move up the ladder. She's going to become a manager, which she does. And not only that, but she's also going to meet this very, very wealthy, you know, son of another, a former governor of the state of New York, who is now, you know, on his road to becoming, you know, the senator from the state of New York. You know, this is what we want to believe. And it's a delusion that, you know, feeds us, you know, psychologically in ways that I assume are beneficial or people wouldn't buy into it.
So we don't resent the wealthy character either in film or in reality because we imagine ourselves in that place.
Lotto Nation is what I call it. We live in Lotto America. Every day, millions and millions of Americans plunk down their hard-earned money on the hope that they're going to hit certain numbers and become millionaires. The chances of doing that are astronomically slim. In the last Powerball, I think it was a trillion or something to one that anybody was going to, you know, win, that any single individual would win that money. But we carry that Lotto idea in our heads. Now, I read you some statistics just a moment ago. Let me read you another set of statistics. This from Time magazine in a survey taken during the 2000 election that asked people if they are in the top 1% of earners. 19% of Americans say that they're in the richest 1%, and a further 20% expect to be someday. There was another poll, I believe, taken by Newsweek.
Wait a second. That's 40% of the country either thinks it is or expects to be, in short order, in the top 1% of earners.
Exactly. Now, if that's not delusional,
that's Prozac
Nation.
That's
you may be right. I may have been wrong. Yes, Prozac Nation may be right. Now, this, you talk about delusional. This is clearly delusional. I mean, 40% are going to be in the top 1%. But my gosh, as a form of social control, isn't this one of the most powerful ideas? In a country where there was, even if there was a belief in social mobility, there was class consciousness.
And politics, how the politicians take advantage of that delusion. 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. The Golden Globes have been awarded and contain some surprises, especially to...
You're listening to The Connection from NPR. My name's Dick Gordon. Our number's 1-800-423-8255. The American dream, the idea that you can be who you want to be, live where you want to live, if not now, then very soon. 1-800-423-TALK. With me on the program today, Neil Gabler. He's author of Life the Movie, How Entertainment Conquered Reality, as well as a number of other books. He's a frequent contributor to the New York Times, the LA Times, Esquire, New York Magazine, and more. And joining us now on the phone from Bethel, Maine, is Jean Kilbourne. She's a visiting scholar at Wellesley College and author of Can't Buy My Love, How Advertising Influences What We Think and feel. Hi, Jean.
Hi there.
You've been listening to Neil describe the life, the movie part of it. Is advertising every bit a contributing factor here?
Absolutely. I've been loving this conversation. I couldn't agree with Neil more. But when he says we're delusional, of course we are, but how could we not be? I mean, after all, we're surrounded by delusions all the time, that the central message of advertising really is that we can instantly transform our lives relatively effortlessly, that if we just buy the right things, we'll be somehow spun into this upper regions. And we're surrounded by this, by these examples of luxury and opulence that seem to be fairly readily available. Just this Sunday in the New York Times Magazine, on the back cover, there's a Toyota ad that shows a man outside of a mansion, and he's washing his Toyota with bottled water. He's got tons of bottled water all around. Now, it's funny, it's clever, but, we see these things, hundreds, thousands of times, this idea that somehow we can live like this. And maybe we can't live quite like this, but we can drink this bottled water. We can have some of it anyway.
But see, what you've described is funny. It's almost silly. How does it play into our sense of, what we can be, or that deluded sense that takes us beyond reality?
One of the ways that it does is it sort of gives us the sense that the rich are sort of just folks, just folks like us. Like the classic example, of course, being George W. Bush, who presents himself as a good old boy, who splits logs on his ranch in Texas and makes grammatical errors, but in fact he's where he is because of his wealth and connections and for no other reason. So that's that idea that in the world of advertising, the world of sitcoms and that sort of thing, we're encouraged to sort of think that we can, they're just like us, therefore we can be like them. We used to compare ourselves with our neighbors, for example, the people down the block, the Joneses, but now we compare ourselves with Ross and Rachel on Friends, with the rich, because we're surrounded by these images of the rich, the wealthy, the celebrities. They're made to seem almost like the people down the street, and therefore we try to be like them. As Juliette Shore argues in her wonderful books, we end up feeling very poor and dissatisfied, but we overspend, we get into a lot of debt, trying to keep up with something that is absolutely out of our reach, really.
In other words, our life movie goes over budget.
It goes way over budget.
They all go over budget.
Way over budget. And when you think about how little people save for retirement, for example, it's just as Neil says, everyone expects to be rich. They're not going to, not everyone, but a lot of people, that they're not going to need it because somehow it's going to happen. They're going to win the lottery, or they're going to marry somebody wealthy. It's going to happen sort of effortlessly. When you think about TV shows, the characters who live lifestyles that they couldn't possibly afford, the cast of Friends, half of them don't really have jobs, or they have sort of half-hearted jobs, but they live, if you add up how much it would cost to live in the kinds of apartments they live in, the way that they live their lives, the clothes they wear, it would be absolutely impossible. And this happens over and over again.
But what I want you to both do, if you can, is explain to me why it is we are so overwhelmed with all these images, that the president goes for a burger in Crawford and he is, as you say, Gene, just folks, or there's a baseball player currently who's being paid $13 million a year and saying he won't play unless he gets $17 million a year. And we kind of consume all that without the degree of resentment, which on the face of it you'd think would be a natural reaction.
Well, Dick, let me take exception. One thing you say. Oddly enough, athletics is the one place where class consciousness survives. Baseball fans, for example, resent high-paid athletes enormously. When there was a threat of a strike this last year, the owners by far had the sympathy of the fans. It's an odd thing where one of the few places where someone's individual labor is directly connected in a visual way, directly connected to their financial rewards, that's one of the places where people seem up in arms. But when you look at somebody like George Bush or Dick Cheney, where the wealth was not earned but is essentially was given, no one seems up in arms. But I think the short answer to your question is that the alternatives are so much worse. To believe that you are fixed in your class and you cannot leave it, to believe that it is not personal responsibility, but other economic and political forces that determine your fate, is something too awful to contemplate. It's much, much better, if not healthier, to believe that you are the master of your own fate.
Can I add something to that? I think I agree with that, Neil. But I also, another reason I think for this, Dick, what you bring up is that there in the media, there are tons of stories about individual successes. And there's, you know, the whole world, we love these stories. But there's very little analysis of economic reality. Very few people have heard even the basic statistics that Neil gave earlier about the widening gap between the rich and the poor. And so that perpetuates this idea that somehow this is commonplace, this can happen. Now, if one were a conspiracy theorist, we could think that perhaps this is somewhat deliberate because an attempt on the part of the media, controlled mostly by a very few very rich folks, don't want people to think about this, don't want people to rise up in arms against these people.
1-800-423-8255. Let's take our first call from Orleans, Indiana. Nick's on the line. Hi, Nick.
How do you do?
Thanks for calling.
Thank you. I would question whether the word delusional is as much the right term or mathematically challenged. One of the things that I teach, I work in industry, and I teach statistics to workforce, to people in the workplace, and I end up telling them that, you know, their odds of winning the lottery are a little greater than mine, and they always wonder why. And I say, well, I don't buy lottery tickets, but it's so different that you can't measure it. I've seen this in just the concept of what is a billion. I ask people what a billion seconds look like, and they have no clue. It's almost 33 years. So when we have this, there's definitely a group of people out here that I call the working poor, but they still believe that they can somehow, you know, grab this magic brass ring or that they can improve.
Do you think, Nick, it's because, as Neil's saying, and Gene, that it's just all around us, the message that opportunity exists?
Oh, I think it is, definitely. And I think it's changed subtly over the years. I'm in my mid-50s, and I can see where initially people, the middle class really determined a lot of what went on, but the middle class is being eroded not only from the wealthy at one end, but there's more and more people becoming poor. And so the very class that set morals and ethics and all of the other things in this culture in the 19th and 20th century are becoming a very small group.
Let me ask Gene first and Neil as well what you two think it would take to pull the gauzy veil away and get people to listen to the type of numbers that Nick's talking about.
Well, one thing would be like a media literacy. I mean, to teach these kinds of things about the media in classrooms throughout the country, as they do in most developed nations, and help people to really think about what these messages are. What are we buying along with these products? What sort of messages do we get from a movie like Made in Manhattan? What is going on here? That would be one thing we could do that might help people become less delusional.
Neil?
I think it's going to be a very difficult sell, and I'll tell you why. It's for what Gene was saying earlier. This is a very powerful narrative, and you need an alternative narrative that is equally powerful, but also equally satisfying. You know, people go to movies with happy endings for a reason, and they generally stay away from movies with downbeat endings for a reason. And what we're talking here, statistically, is a downbeat ending. What conservatives generally have offered and what the popular culture is generally offering is an upbeat ending. So what you have to do is you have to come up with an alternative narrative that not necessarily makes people happy, but that makes people angry. And we had the beginnings of one with the whole Enron debacle. There was a narrative where people could clearly see how greed had changed the American economy. And if it had been seized upon, if it had been turned into a more powerful narrative and not allowed to kind of atrophy, it might have posed that kind of armature, might have provided that kind of armature on which we could be making a serious debate about the change in the American economy and about the gap between the rich and the poor. But it wasn't seized upon that way, and so it hasn't been used in that fashion.
Let's go back to our lines now to Lincoln, Massachusetts. Peter's joining us. Hello, Peter. Peter, are you there? No, we seem to be missing Peter. We'll go to Raleigh, North Carolina. Rachel's on the line. Hi, Rachel.
Yes, hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Oh, still there?
Go ahead, yes. Rachel. Peter, we'll get back to you if we can.
Okay, great. I just have one comment. I am in a new organization right now, 2 years, And I am quickly changing my class from the poor or middle. I don't know what really what I am right now. I'm just a college, just out of college. But I am on route to change my class, so you could say, from poor, middle to wealthy. And I've found this business opportunity that has been educating me on how money works, how money can work for me, and why the poor and middle class usually stay poor in middle class. And I think that this delusion that we're talking about, or this conversation alone, is only reinforcing that dream that many Americans have, that they just have their class, they just have to stay in their class, unless sometime they can get that one good tip if they're a waiter, or that one good marriage proposal if they're that maid in Manhattan. I have lost that dream. I used to have that. I really have a teacher education. I'm en route to be a teacher of Spanish here in Raleigh, but I've begun to change that dream, and through learning, through this business, has really taught me that this can all change very quickly if I put a little bit of work into it, and if I begin to change my thinking patterns, and that's what I'm beginning to do. And
do you buy lottery tickets, Rachel?
No, sir. Not at all.
Because that whole idea of what you can marry a millionaire, you think it's all just bunkum?
Those things do happen, of course. And I'm a waitress, and every day before I began to be involved in this organization, I used to think every day, you know, maybe I'll get that one tip. And it was such a dream for me, and it was so ridiculous. I think maybe someone's going to come in here who's very wealthy, and they see me, and they see that I'm living my life as hard as I can, and they're going to give me $100 today, and it's going to make my day. And you know what? I never come out, even if I make the more money than I've ever made before at that restaurant, I never come out a rich woman. That will never happen. What I have begun to do is change my thinking patterns. Instead of saying, oh, I'm poor, I'm middle class, this is my class, and this is what I'll always be, and I'll never be able to get that trip to Europe that I've always wanted. I'll never be able to buy this for my children. Now I can say, okay, I have this asset. Let me begin to buy other assets. Let me take this money that I usually buy at Walmart or the mall or at the movies, and let me start actually putting it towards my future smartly. And
Rachel, let me just step in here if I can and ask Neil, because as Rachel's giving like a couple of messages, Neil, one is the dream really does have some kind of value, but not to get too seduced by it, no?
Yes. I mean, she's giving kind of mixed messages here. I think you're absolutely right. I mean, on the one hand, she's saying, I used to have these dreams and I realize that they are kind of empty. But on the other hand, I have another dream now, and that dream may be fulfilled. And I think this is, you know, exactly the way that, you know, society is been operating when it comes to economics. I mean, no one wants to stop dreaming. To stop dreaming is a kind of living death. On the other hand, you know, if you don't wake up and see that the massive redistribution, it is a massive redistribution of wealth from the middle class to the wealthy. As this economy has grown, I mean, trickle down is, you know, a wonderful psychological theory, if not an economic, a wonderful economic theory, because what it essentially says is if you get a little piece of the action, you'll be satisfied, even though others are getting a giant piece of the action. And Americans seem to be content. I mean, how in the world could you have a president of the United States, in all seriousness, propose a massive tax giveaway to the wealthy at a time when the economy is in a shambles and no one seems to be up in arms about it? But it's an amazing thing.
Gene, the fascinating thing and follow from what Neil's saying is, though, that to wake up and to look seriously at the statistics is to, in some way, acknowledge the difficulty that everyone is in their class. Who wants to say, oh, I really don't have a chance here?
Well, that's certainly true. And as Neil has said, I mean, that it's important to people to have that sense of a possibility of a happy outcome and a happy ending and that sort of thing. But the great irony, of course, is that the delusion keeps people from really achieving the dream, in a sense. I mean, if there were an uproar, for example, about this massive redistribution of wealth, then perhaps people could be elected who would change things so that we would all have a much fairer shot or a better chance at it.
But look what happened when Al Gore tried to say in the last election, I'm going to fight for you little guys. Nobody wanted that. Nobody
wants to identify with being the little guy. Nobody wants to identify. We want to identify. We identify with the wealthy. We're going to be there someday. As Neil said, 40% believe that. So therefore, that's why people with the estate tax. I mean, the estate tax is going to benefit, what, Neil, about 2% of people. But if you ask people, you know, a huge number think that it's going to benefit them. It really will benefit only the extremely wealthy. So it's really, it is a kind of national delusion, but it's one that's costing us dearly.
But, and it's also, I think one might say that when Al Gore tried to raise the issue of class consciousness, he was knocked down for being almost unpatriotic. Because when you subscribe to the idea of free social mobility, so long as you, you know, work hard, you will achieve whatever you want to achieve. It's almost unpatriotic. It's un-American to challenge that idea. It's un-American to say, wait a minute, systemically speaking, it doesn't work that way. You can work very, very hard and you won't become wealthy in this country because there are so many other variables involved. So, you know, but no one in politics wants to address that for fear of being accused of being un-American. I mean, this is another tradition in America that's relatively deep, that if you raise the issue of class, you're either, you know, a socialist or you're a communist or you're someone who is somehow un-American or anti-American.
We're going to have to take a short break, and I'll use this opportunity, Gene, to say thank you for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Jean Kilborn from Bethel, Maine. She's a visiting scholar at Wellesley College and author of Can't Buy My Love, How Advertising Changes How We Think and Feel. Connection listeners, how do you think and feel about this? Join us when we come back. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.
Who wants to be a millionaire?
I don't.
Have flashy flunkies everywhere.
I don't.
Who wants the bother of a country estate?
A country estate is something I'd hate.
Right. Who wants to wallow in champagne?
I don't.
Who wants an island off of Spain?
I don't. Who wants a marble swimming pool too? I don't.
And I don't, 'cause all I want is...
You're listening to The Connection from NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. As Horatio Alger would say at the end of another story, the little tin savings bank still stands on the mantelpiece and never fails to receive a deposit daily. And that's how you get to own a bunch of skyscrapers in New York. We're going next to Boston, Massachusetts, and Tom's joining our conversation about class. Is it there, Tom? What do you think?
Yeah, hi. You know, I agree with a lot of what people said about you know, the sense of delusion of the American dream. But I think there's a value to it, too, and I think there's a certain social and historical basis for it. There's a number of generations of this country that did come here and did have the American dream and were able to pull themselves up by their bootstraps, and it's still a dream that brings people here from other countries. So while being delusional about being able to, you know, win the lotto, course, doesn't help anyone. I think there's a certain value that shouldn't be discounted to the American dream.
Are you saying it's a more of a motivational value than a necessarily, you know, saying I too will drive a Jaguar someday?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, like I say, it's a difference between the delusional part and saying, you know, well, here's an engine, here's an opportunity that, you know, if I do work hard, maybe I can get ahead. And you know, if you look at the number of generations that was true for, then there is a social context for that. It's not just the Made in Manhattan movies. There's generations of my father and,
right,
and my father's father that actually did achieve that dream. And I think that's a social context of this country. We can't just disregard saying it's all advertising. It's certainly changed since
right.
then. And I think, you know, it's more difficult today to say, well, my children will be, you know, easily move ahead and do better than I did. But for a long time, that was true, or at least there was a strong sense of sensibility that was true in this country.
Neil.
Tom is absolutely correct, and I think he's correct on both fronts. Number one, I think it was easier in the past to move from one class to another than it is now. There were policies in the government that helped people move from one class to another. Remember, there was once upon a time the highest tax bracket was 90%. Now, you know, the Bush administration is proposing lowering that to, you know, I think now 32%. So there were policies that encouraged the poor and the middle class to move. Those things are being discouraged now. And Tom is right on the second front, and it's much more difficult. It's much more difficult for me to think of my children as exceeding me than it was for me to think of myself exceeding my father, my father exceeding my grandfather. And one of the reasons why, of course, is that now government policies discourage that kind of movement. You know, when you talk about a tax cut, the first tax cut, which was something like $1.3 trillion, most of that money, of course, goes to the wealthy. But you also don't think of this in terms of a zero-sum game. That's money that's also taken away from other possible uses, like education, which would benefit the middle class and the poor more than it would benefit the wealthy. So when you think of it just in those terms, of all the things that that money could do to encourage and expedite social mobility, you see why the class lines are becoming harder and hardening, I should say, in this generation and promises to be true for the next generations to come.
All right, Tom, thanks for your call to Providence, Rhode Island. George is joining us. Hi, George.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah, go ahead.
As you can hear, I am foreign born. But when I came, Johnson was the president. So I've been here a long, long time. And I am amazed at the level of credulity of society, of taking this dream that everything is possible. It is, you say if it's conspiratory, then one would think that this is on purpose. I don't think there is a small rumor that the people sort of decide on this thing. But the whole atmosphere is such to encourage making people believe that everything is possible. Now, I am not driving a Jaguar, although I could. My wife is a physician, and I have a good professional career. And I resent the verdict. I resent the fact that Bill Gates can have $50 billion and decide things. That money gives you that kind of power. So I think you have to be born here and somehow soak it in from the beginning. Because otherwise, I don't know how to explain this hostility, let's say, to the war message.
But, George, are you saying that if your son and daughter, born here, don't share that same?
No, my son and daughter, they grew up in a different family. They grew up in my family, and they very much think like I do. And another thing about getting things...
But they were born here.
Yes, they were born here. Yes, they were born here. But again, and I'm saying is, you know, you bring from home a lot of background, and they brought my background. Now, I'm not personally complaining. We are making the kind of money that many people would think we are really rich. But I feel poor, in a sense, when I compare to the ones who are really, really rich. And
let me, if I can, interrupt you for just a minute, George, and ask Neil to come in here, because it's really interesting. I mean, here we have a physician who, you know, will be well compensated in the country, who's expressing some of the same frustration, in part because he comes from another country, but in part because he's drawn to compare himself to a Bill Gates.
Yes, although interestingly enough, Bill Gates' father has been one of the chief promoters of the idea that there ought to be an increased inheritance tax. I mean, even he realizes that the inheritance tax, by reducing and ultimately getting rid of the inheritance tax, which is the Bush plan in the year 2010, that you're just going to, again, harden class lines and create a perpetual aristocracy in this country. But again, George is speaking to the issue, and the issue is that there is not class consciousness in this country any longer. There once was class consciousness, even though there was a belief, as I said earlier, in social mobility. But today, there is virtually no class consciousness at all. No one begrudges the wealthy their money, even though that money generally comes out of their pockets in terms of tax policy and other things, because they all believe that it's going to come to them, and it may come to them. They may be in that group who gets those benefits at one time, or because they're bought off through the you know, trickle-down theory that they'll get a couple of dollars here, and that will satisfy them, that will pacify them.
George, thanks for your call. Next to Lincoln, Massachusetts, Sam's joining us. Hello, Sam.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
You know, the thing that occurs to me is that nobody begrudges the rich because they don't know how the system works. And I would wonder what all the guests think about how things would shift if economics were taught in school. I mean, it seems that most people can't even follow this conversation, or many people can't, because they don't know what a zero-sum game is, or they don't know. I think it's a nation of economically illiterate people. And we should teach economic literacy and somehow connect economic theory, how money works, how markets work, how markets are essentially about information. All that stuff should be taught in school.
But Sam, are you saying that if that was taught in school, people would not aspire to the, you know, to be a millionaire? Or are you saying that people would understand actually how to get there?
I'm saying that people would at least be able to follow this conversation and be able to parse out propaganda or parse out silly theories, because most people don't get an opportunity to see how money works because it's not taught. If you had an opportunity to see how money works, it would be patently obvious how ridiculous trickle-down economics is. If people were taught that, they'd say, this is ridiculous. It would just be so obviously phony. And I guess my point is that we don't teach economics in school. That's it. We just don't teach it.
I'm just wondering, though, Sam, and I'll ask Neil to help with this, whether or not something taught at, even if it's taught, you know, at grade 6th and 10th grade, whether or not it's going to have the ability to create some kind of intellectual defense against the onslaught of culture, which says all and everything is possible for everyone. Neil.
Yeah, Dick, I mean, I think you're absolutely right. I think that, you know, what we're dealing with here is, you know, theory versus the reality of a popular culture that is all around us, that is essentially part of our consciousness now. I mean, this is, you know, popular culture is part of the way we perceive the world. And, you know, as I've said earlier, I mean, this idea is so powerful, this idea that it's all in our own hands, that it's there for our taking if we, you know, have the will, the determination to take it, that wealth, that, I mean, I think that would trump any kind of economic theory. Though I will say, and I think Sam is right in this, and I'll tell you where the dereliction is. It's not necessarily in school. I think it's in the media, and I think it's with journalism. I think journalists ought to be far more careful in the way they scrutinize, you know, economic policy in this country. And that's not to say that they ought to just only give a liberal side of economic policy, mm-hmm. but that they ought to scrutinize, that they ought to discuss, that they ought to analyze, so that when something like the new Bush economic policy comes down, we have all sides. We understand fully its implications. That's something that I think the media has not done well.
Yeah, but you know,
possibly
the fascinating,
because they don't always understand it.
Sorry, Neil, but the fascinating thing about that is that if you compare two paragraphs in the newspaper, and one of them is George Bush, who has this sort of just folks presentation saying this is good for you, it's good for your children. And then the other paragraph is some smart-ass liberal economist cultural elite saying this is bad for you. It seems to me that the average reader is more drawn to believe the president rather than the critic that you're talking about.
Well, I think there are other ways of presenting this information and in a balanced fashion. I mean, just looking at the implications without necessarily, you know, tapping critics of Bush or without tapping Bush himself, just looking at statistically what the effects of the new economic policy are going to be, mm-hmm. And discussing that. And you get very, very little discussion of that in real terms, except to say, for example, that, you know, repeating President Bush's line that the average family of four making $40,000 a year will get, you know, an average of, you know, $1,000 from my tax cut. Well, I mean, as someone said the other day, I mean, that's like saying that when, you know, Bill Gates walks into a room of 50, that the average person in the room, you know, is worth, you know, $5 billion. Mm-hmm. I mean, if the rich are getting the vast proportion of this tax cut, then the average is meaningless.
I wonder, though, if popular culture is so responsible for directing us in one direction, whether or not it'll be popular culture at some level, which turns the corner and takes us in the other direction. I'm thinking of, you know, All in the Family, Archie Bunker in the 1970s was considered to be a bit of a groundbreaking piece of media because it did change the narrative in a way. Do you see something like that happening?
Well, the interesting thing about economic policy and class consciousness is that it hasn't usually worked on personification. I mean, it had worked on institutionalization. For example, in the late 19th century, it wasn't that they were pointing fingers, those who had class consciousness, at Andrew Carnegie necessarily, or later at Rockefeller. I mean, it was at plutocracy itself, at the railroads, at the trusts. There were these grand institutions. You know, popular culture works on the basis of personification. And I'm not sure that popular culture can bridge that gap between the personal and the institutional that is so necessary here in understanding, you know, how the system has to be changed.
Unless you get people talking about Ken Lay all over again.
Exactly, exactly. And I'm not sure that, in fact, we have evidence that it hasn't happened, that you can go from Ken Lay very easily to systemic problems with the distribution of wealth in this country. It's not an easy leap to make. And yet that's the kind of leap you have to make because, despite what one of our earlier callers was saying about teaching economics, people think in terms of antidote. They think in terms of narrative. I mean, that's one of the reasons why conservatives have been so successful in pushing their agenda, is because conservatives better understand the aesthetics of politics. Liberals don't get it. Their aesthetics are all wrong. And until they get their aesthetics right, the conservatives will always control the agenda.
Neil, thanks so much for being with us.
It was really a pleasure, Dick. Thank you.
Neil Gabler, cultural historian, film scholar, author most recently of the book Life the Movie, How Entertainment Conquered Reality. Earlier in the program, we talked with Gene Kilbourn, visiting scholar at Wellesley College and author of Can't Buy My Love, How Advertising Changes How We Think and Feel. Connection listeners, I invite you to continue this conversation on our webpages. We're at theconnection.org. Our program is produced by Sean Carberry, Sarah Field, Elaine Grant, Kelly Jones, Orit Karitsky-Fox, Lindsay Miller, Christina Russo, and Doug Sugarts. Tara Murphy's our senior producer. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.
Funding for The Connection is made possible by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Purchase cassettes and CDs of The Connection, please visit www.theconnection.org or phone 1-800-909-9287.
This is WBU.